Chapter 18. Bombay Revisited. Towards the end of August, when I had been living at Craigside for less than a year, the landlord informed me that the property had been bought by a wealthy Tibetan refugee and that the new owner wanted to move in right away. Though I had not been following events in Tibet very closely, I knew the Chinese were tightening their grip on the country and that the Tibetans were becoming increasingly restive. I also knew that members of the aristocratic governing class had started arriving in Kalimpong in greater numbers, and that many of them were buying from the Marwaris at vastly inflated prices, such English-style houses and bungalows as happened to be on the market. It was one of these moneyed new arrivals, I gathered, who had taken a fancy to Craigside and made our landlord an offer the latter felt unable to refuse. The idea of our leaving Craigside did not disturb me personally, even though I knew that the move to new premises would mean an interruption to my work on the survey. I had put down no roots in the place, and there was nothing about it I would regret as much as I had regretted the loss of the garden when we left the Hermitage. But if the idea of our leaving Craigside did not disturb me personally, it certainly disturbed me in my capacity as bhikshu in charge of the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society. Since my arrival in the town more than 5 years earlier, I had conducted Buddhist activities at and from as many as 5 different premises, and well knew the disruptive effect a change of location could have on those activities. But there was no help for it. We had to leave Craigside, a new place had to be found, and I accordingly asked our members and friends to look out for a suitable property that was available at a rent we could afford. In the end, it was Chanilal, our landlord, who found our new home for us and persuaded the owners to let us have it for 130 rupees a month, which was still 30 rupees more than we were paying at present. Where the extra money was going to come from, I did not know, but trusting it would come from somewhere, as it always did when really needed, I closed the deal and prepared to move. Everton Villa was situated on the outskirts of the development area, not far from Panorama, which meant that it was about 2 miles from the bazaar. Like Panorama, it occupied a broad hillside terrace, and like Panorama, it commanded a magnificent view of the Darjeeling foothills, as well as the foothills of Western Sikkim. Like Panorama too, it was not overlooked by any other building, and was strangely quiet, not only at night, but even during the day. Oblong in shape, with a roof of so low a pitch that it was almost flat, the isolated, unpretentious bungalow contained 3 large rooms at the front, and 3 much smaller ones at the back. The middle room at the front, which was very large, opened on to a narrow veranda running the whole length of the building. Behind there was a kitchen, storeroom and servants' quarters, and on one side a square of lawn, in the centre of which stood a small monkey puzzle tree. Access was by means of a flight of stone steps that, from the Pucker Road, connecting the upper and lower cart roads, ran down to the square of lawn. When Chanilal first took me to see Everton Villa, I was not favourably impressed. It had been empty for a couple of years. Why, I discovered only later, and presented a shabby, neglected appearance. The roof leaked, some windows were broken, and on the walls of the front rooms, patches of mould had developed, so that the area indoors was damp and musty. However, the owners undertook to repair and decorate the place. Within little more than a week, the work was finished, and on a rainy day in mid-September, I moved into our new abode, now smelling of paint and varnish, and wearing a brighter, more cheerful look. A few days later came Anigarika Dhammapala's birth anniversary, which we celebrated under Ananda Ji's presidentship with the usual speeches in honour of, quote, the greatest Buddhist missionary of modern times. And the following day I resumed work on the survey. Not that the work on the survey was merely resumed. I actually put on a spurt in the course of the next few weeks. Not only succeeded in finishing Chapter 3 on the Mahayana schools, but also made a good start on Chapter 4, which is on the Bodhisattva ideal, with which the book concluded. What made it possible for me to put on the spurt was the fact that, though I still taught at the Dharmodaya Vihara's evening college and still gave lessons to Durga and his friends, I was no longer having to devote time to the rewriting of Lobsang Phuntsok's article on Tibetan Buddhism, the handwritten draft of which had eventually come to comprise more than 300 foolscap pages. I had finished the work a week before moving into Everton Villa, and had handed the last typed corrected sheets to the grateful young Tibetan aristocrat with a feeling akin to relief. It was well that I had finished it when I did. Dr. Kenneth W. Morgan, the American scholar who had commissioned the article, arrived in Kalimpong a few days later, and Lobsang was able to deliver the completed manuscript to him personally in Dada Rinpoche's and my presence. The following year, edited and drastically shortened, the article appeared in Dr. Morgan's The Path of the Buddha, which also contains an article by Kashyapji on Origin and Expansion of Buddhism. As the material for Lobsang's article had been supplied by Dada Rinpoche, and as the Rinpoche himself had been educated at Drepung, the manuscript delivered to the American scholar inevitably reflected the more intellectual Buddhism of the great Gelug monastic universities. Towards the end of September and during the month of October, I became better acquainted with a very different kind of Tibetan Buddhism. This was the ethnic, almost tribal Buddhism of the inhabitants of the Tamang village at Seventh Mile. Despite their living just down the road, so to speak, for one reason or another, I had seen much less of these rustic followers of Padmasambhava than I had of their more numerous co-religionists in Darjeeling. But recently they had invited me to give a lecture for their special benefit in the village school. Down to Seventh Mile one afternoon I therefore went and spoke for an hour and a half on the Three Jewels. So successful was this lecture, which was attended not only by the Tamangs themselves, but by their Hindu neighbours, that in the course of the next few months, I was invited to give two more lectures, and accordingly spoke on meditation and the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum, and on, quote, the Buddhist world. The first lecture having dealt with the fundamentals of Buddhism, of which I knew the Tamangs to be woefully ignorant, in the second I sought to elucidate the sacred formula with which they were familiar, but of which they had little or no understanding. And in the third, to give them an idea of the extent and diversity of the religion to which they belonged, and of which their own tradition formed a part. At the conclusion of the third lecture, I was taken to see the Gompa, which stood a little apart from the village. It was very small and comprised no more than a single whitewashed room, at the far end of which, on a low platform, sat three life-sized clay images. The images represented Buddha Amitabha, Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, and the precious guru Padmasambhava, the traditional Nyingma triad. All three were of extremely crude workmanship and painted in colours which must have looked gaudy when new. The art of a religion, I reflected, tended to flourish or decline as the religion itself flourished or declined. And if images in a Tamang Gompa were crude, it was probably because the Nepalese followers of the precious guru had long been out of touch with the spirit of the Nyingma tradition. After seeing the Gompa, I took tea at the house of a sympathetic Hindu Nyuwa, with whom I discussed the possibility of buying land at Seventh Mile and building a monastery there. For remote as Everton Villa was from the bazaar, a wealthy Tibetan refugee was just as likely to take a fancy to it as to Craigside, in which case we should be homeless again. Sooner or later, it seemed, the Kalimpong branch of the Mahabodhi Society would have to acquire its own permanent premises. I therefore continued to think of buying land at Seventh Mile, and did so for some time, but nothing ever came of the idea. In any case, shortly after giving my lecture on the Buddhist world, I left for Bombay, and when I returned to Kalimpong 6 months later, I had other things to think about. There were two reasons for my making the trip to Bombay. Towards the end of 1952, after taking part in the re-enshrinement of the relics of the Arahants Shariputra and Moggallyayana at Sanchi, I had spent 3 weeks in the city as the guest of Raj Kapoor, the famous film star, who was planning to produce a film with a Buddhist theme and wanted to consult with me about it. During those weeks, I struck up a friendship with Arjun Dev Rashk, the young Punjabi scriptwriter of the film, which was to be called Ajanta, after the famous cave temples, and we had kept up a desultory correspondence ever since. Recently, he had been urging me to pay another visit to Bombay. Raj Kapoor was again thinking seriously about Ajanta, he wrote, and he himself was busy revising the script and badly in need of my assistance. Would I please come as soon as possible? The other reason for my going to Bombay was that the Wadias wanted me to give a couple of lectures there, and that I needed, in any case, to discuss with B.P. Wadia the forthcoming publication of the survey, now complete except for the last four sections of Chapter 4. On the 1st of November, having delivered my usual full moon day sermon the previous night, I therefore travelled down to Siliguri and caught the evening train to Katihar Junction. Fortunately, I was not having to make the long journey across the subcontinent on my own, as Sachin had decided to accompany me. He had passed his IA examination with honours, and after spending 2 weeks with me in Bombay, would be joining college in Calcutta and reading for an arts degree. At Katihar Junction, which we reached at 2 a.m, we had to wait 12 hours for our connection, and it was another 12 hours before we reached Benares. 10 minutes earlier, I'd been surprised to see the pink sandstone tower of the Mulagandakuti Vihara appearing above the trees, as I had not realised that we would be approaching Benares from the Sarnath side. In the city of Ghats, our train arrived after we had been waiting little more than an hour, and soon we were again on our way. 18 hours later, when we had enjoyed a good night's rest, Sachin on the luggage rack, I on the bench below, we found ourselves clanking slowly through the insalubrious suburbs of Bombay, and steaming at last into the soot-blackened neo-Gothic splendours of the Victoria Terminus. My friend Saratha, the little monk, was there to meet us. In the absence of a permanent bhikshu in charge, he was spending his holiday at Devapriya's request, looking after the Ananda Vihara, one of the Mahabodhi Society's two centres in Bombay, and it was to the Ananda Vihara that he joyfully took us to stay. The modest two-storey building was situated on a busy thoroughfare in the heart of the city, not far from Bombay Central Railway Station, and stood in a corner of the near-hospital compound. Vihara and hospital had been built in the 20s by the late Dr. Anandrayo Nair, a wealthy physician from South India, who had become a Buddhist, or at least a very good friend of Buddhism, and who had organised the Buddhist Society, Bombay. The hospital was, of course, much bigger than the Vihara, and in fact seemed likely to squeeze the latter out of existence. It was also much busier. Not more than half a dozen people came to the Vihara from 1 week's end to the next, Sir Arthur told me, whereas hundreds came to the hospital every day, as I could see for myself by looking out the window. Moreover, in the centre of the common courtyard between the Vihara and the main entrance to the hospital, stood a small Hindu shrine, which may or may not have been built by Dr. Nair. This was constantly thronged with worshippers, mostly women, either praying for someone's recovery or giving thanks for a cure. None of them even glanced in the direction of Vihara, much less entered its modest portals, or sat quietly for a few minutes in front of the big alabaster Buddha, as Dr. Nair apparently had hoped they would. The Ananda Vihara was in fact distinctly underused. Vaishakha Purnima was celebrated every year, and there was the occasional lecture, and that was about all. Saratha, however, was determined that the place should not be underused while he was in charge, albeit temporarily, and least of all while I was in Bombay and available as a speaker. He had therefore made arrangements for me to give two lectures at the Vihara. quite a few people, it seemed, wanted me to give lectures for them that winter. So much was this the case that not long after my arrival, when I had met Madame Wadia, Rask, and other friends, and had an idea what I would be doing in Bombay, the little monk and I drew up a programme of my lectures for the next 5 or 6 weeks. I gave my first two lectures at Arya Sangha, the Wadia mansion on Malambar Hill, in what evidently had been the ballroom. As they were held under the joint auspices of the PEN, the Indian Institute of Culture, Bombay branch, the Mahabodhi Society of India, Bombay branches, and the Indian Council for Cultural Cooperation. Both lectures were attended by what the newspapers were accustomed to describe as the cultural elite of Bombay. In the first lecture, Buddhism as Doctrine and as Method, I emphasized that the criterion of truth was pragmatic, and that as doctrine, Buddhism might be defined as a body of teachings, the intellectual acceptance of which tended to lead to a course of action, eventually resulting in the attainment of enlightenment. As was famously illustrated by the Buddha's parable of the raft, doctrine had only a relative and provisional value, and it was because they were convinced of the relativity of their own doctrines that Buddhists could be undogmatic and therefore tolerant. The course of action following from acceptance of the doctrines of Buddhism and resulting in the attainment of enlightenment was threefold, consisting of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. All the methods of Buddhism, comprising its entire practical side, could be included under one or another of these heads. As method, Buddhism therefore comprised all those practices that were conducive to enlightenment. After enlightenment, doctrine or wisdom meant the actual realization of truth, and method, the dynamic compassion that caused us spontaneously to help others. Not that we needed to wait for enlightenment before helping others. Buddhism included both the path of the Arahant and the path of the Bodhisattva, and helping oneself and helping others were systole and diastole of a spiritual life at all its levels. My second lecture, entitled Inspiration-Whence? Given a few days later, was of a more general nature. Though artistic inspiration might appear to come from without, in reality it came from within. The artist was not wholly passive. He had an active or creative aspect to his being. Creation meant expression, and expression meant communication, for which a common medium was necessary. Formerly, ideas derived from tradition, especially religious tradition, provided that medium. Not that the purpose of a work of art was to communicate ideas. Its purpose was to communicate feeling, for want of a better term. But feeling could not be communicated without ideas. Though there was no poetry, for example, without intellectual content, poetry was not identical with intellectual content. In modern times, because tradition was breaking down, there was no proper medium of communication. We did not know what to believe, and hence there was chaos in the arts. Modern artists were open to low-level inspiration, with results that were often unintelligible, as in the case of surrealism. The two great difficulties facing the artist today were, one, to remain open to high-level inspiration, which could be done with the help of yoga, the poet was, after all, the prophet, and two, to have a philosophy of life. Ideally, inspiration should come from the highest possible level and be expressed in the most universal terms. Literature should elevate. Nowadays, it merely depressed. Both lectures were well received by my cosmopolitan, not uncritical audience, and after each of them I was besieged by people who wanted to ask questions or simply to meet me. The second lecture indeed aroused a quite exceptional degree of interest. This was due partly to the nature of the subject, which was of special concern to the many people present who were involved with the arts, and partly to the fact that, having taken the measure of my audience, I spoke with considerable feeling and gave what, in my opinion, was a particularly good lecture. Among the people who besieged me afterwards, there was a short, middle-aged woman in a Western-style frock, who, being more pertinacious than the rest, was soon claiming my exclusive attention. So excited was she, and so voluble, that it was not easy for me to make out what she wanted to convey. Eventually I gathered that in my lecture I had given utterance to some of her own deepest beliefs, that she painted and meditated, that she considered herself a Buddhist, that she wanted me to meet someone called Dr. Metta, and that she would be coming to the island of Vihara in a few days' time and taking me to her place for tea. Thus began a connection that was to last many years and be the occasion, before long, of my making new friends and extending the sphere of my activities. After the lectures at Aryasanga came the lectures Saratha had arranged for me to give at the island of Vihara. I gave them the following weekend, and being held under the auspices of the same group of organisations as before, they were attended by much the same kind of people, who, if they came in considerably smaller numbers, at least came out of a more definite interest in Buddhism. Unfortunately, the atmosphere of the second meeting, when I spoke on Buddhist meditation, was initially spoiled by some long-winded and unnecessary remarks from the chair. Madame Wadia had introduced my first lecture at Aryasanga by reading aloud one of my poems. Sir H. V. Devatia, the Vice-Chancellor of Ahmedabad University, had introduced the second with a few appropriate words, while the well-known Pali scholar Dr. N. K. Bhagwat, who had presided at the Ananda Vihara the previous day, when I spoke on Buddhism and the future of India, had followed up my lecture by heartily concurring with my belief that Buddhism still had much to contribute to the land of its birth. Silver-haired Dr. Kaikini, a tall, angular figure in a grey, Western-style suit, chose to do things differently. His introduction was a rambling, incoherent discourse in which he perpetrated, in the course of half an hour, more blunders about Buddhism than I had encountered during the previous 12 months. Before I could speak on Buddhist meditation, I therefore had to explain, Pacey, the president of the meeting, what Buddhism did not teach. This unpropitious beginning did not prevent my lecture from being a success, and to judge by the length of the ensuing discussion, Buddhist meditation was a subject in which many members of the audience were deeply interested. Nonetheless, I was dismayed that Dr. Kaikini had been able to air his muddled views on such an occasion, especially as he was one of the leading members, an office-bearer, I think, of the Ananda Vihara branch of the Mahabodhi Society, as the Buddha Society had become after Dr. Nair's death. If the tiny Buddhist movement of Bombay had many friends like Dr. Kaikini, I reflected, it would not need enemies. Not that the Ananda Vihara was the only Buddhist centre at which I had cause for dismay, or at least for disappointment, that week. 2 days after giving my lecture on Buddhist meditation, I spoke at the Bahujana Vihara in Parel, and at the Japanese Buddhist temple, Worli. The Bahujana Vihara, the Mahabodhi Society's other branch in Bombay, was situated down a side street in a working-class district, dominated by factory chimneys. It consisted of a Sinhalese-style preaching hall, open on three sides, and having a stoop at the far end, and a small bungalow for the accommodation of the bhikshu in charge. Despite its name, which meant Vihara of or for the masses, it did not enjoy much support among the local people, most of whom were in any case Hindus, and according to Saratha, it was almost as underused as its sister Vihara in the near hospital compound. Its principal function was to serve as a hostelry for Sinhalese Buddhists, and it was probably no coincidence that my audience that evening should have included a party of 31 monks on pilgrimage from Ceylon. I spoke on Dhamma Vijaya, or conquest by righteousness, as opposed to conquest by force. And at the conclusion of my lecture, I appealed to the monks, their lay guide interpreting, to come forward and assist in the propagation of Buddhism in India, which I said was severely handicapped for want of workers. My appeal fell on deaf ears. For all the response I received, I might as well have appealed to the stupor behind me. The faces of the 31 yellow-robed figures betrayed not so much as a flicker of interest. Most of them, indeed, seemed more dead than alive. At the Japanese Buddhist temple, where I spoke on the message of Buddhism to a very attentive audience, the situation was hardly better. The scheduled castes Hindus who frequented the place had learned to chant Nam-myo Renge-kyo, or Homage to the Lotus Sutra, to the thunderous accompaniment of the big temple drum, and that was about all. What the Lotus Sutra was, and why they were paying homage to it, they did not know. And as the Nichiranite monk or priest who banged the drum for an hour and a half every evening spoke only Japanese, he was not in a position to enlighten them. With the Anada Vihara being underused or even misused, the Bahujana Vihara serving mainly as a hostelry for Sinhalese pilgrims, and the Japanese Buddhist temple confining itself to drum beating and chanting in Japanese, it appeared that Buddhism in Bombay was not in a very flourishing condition. I even began to suspect that it had been in better shape during the 20s and the early 30s, when Dr. Nair organized the Buddha Society and built the Ananda Vihara. This suspicion of mine was soon confirmed. Though Dr. Nair had been dead more than 20 years, his widow was still living in the city, and shortly after giving my Parel and Worli lectures, I found myself partaking of a ceremonial food offering in a block of flats that had once been in the family mansion, and listening to her rapturous accounts of what her philanthropic physician husband had done for the poor of Bombay and for Buddhism. She was in fact very pleased to see me and overjoyed to be able to show me her Buddhist treasures, as she called the various works of art Dr. Nair had collected over the years. Treasures indeed there were, the collection including, as it did, magnificent bronze and alabaster Buddhas from Thailand and Burma, Gandharan's sculptured panels, Japanese folding screens, Chinese porcelain pagodas, copies of Ajanta frescoes, and large modern oil paintings of scenes from the life of the Buddha, together with 100 objets d'art in ivory, crystal, and sandalwood. Alas, they were all crammed into 2 or 3 shuttered rooms and covered in dust. After Dr. Nair's death, the family fortunes had declined. Mrs. Nair had been obliged to withdraw into a corner of the mansion, letting out the rest, and had neither the space in which to display her treasures, nor the means to look after them. By this time, Sachin and I had been in Bombay a fortnight. While I lectured and met Buddhists and sympathisers with Buddhism, he had been looking up old friends who were either studying or working in the city, especially the film actress Mala Sinha and her parents, who were Nepalese and hailed from Kurseong. But now his holiday was over, and it was time for him to leave for Calcutta, and for me to get back to the survey, and to start helping Rask revise the script of Ajanta. On the evening of the day on which Mrs. Nair showed me her Buddhist treasures, I accordingly saw my young companion off at VT, as the Victoria Terminus was universally known, and the following day moved to Rask's ground floor flat at Kar, a newish middle-class suburb on the western side of the Bombay Peninsula. I was sorry to say goodbye to Sachin, especially as for the next 2 years we would not be seeing so much of each other, and sorry to leave the Ananda Vihara, where Saratha and I had enjoyed our usual lively exchanges, and where, moreover, I had made friends with a young Burmese monk who happened to be staying there. This young monk was exceptionally good-looking, and I was not surprised to learn that thereby hung a tale. He told me the tale not long after we had got to know each other, and though he told it in a simple, unaffected manner, It was the kind of story to which only the colourful, impressionistic pen of a Lafcadio Hearn could really have done justice, in the sense of sketching in its idyllic background, exploiting its romantic interest, and bringing out the characters of the two people involved. The scene of the story was a small monastery on the outskirts of a village in the heart of rural Burma. There, Visuddhisara, or Essence of Purity, as the good-looking young monk was called, had lived with the learned elder under whose direction he was studying. Each morning, as the custom was, the two monks went into the village with their alms bowls, moving silently from door to door until they had collected enough rice and curry for their one meal of the day. On festival days and other special occasions, however, the villagers brought food to the monastery and served it to the monks on the broad veranda. Two of the villagers, a mother and her unmarried daughter, were especially assiduous in this respect. By the time Visuddhisara had been at the monastery a few months, they were bringing food to him and his teacher every day, so that the two monks no longer had to go into the village with their alms bowls. One day the daughter came alone. Her mother was ill, she explained. As it happened, Visuddhisara's teacher had gone to visit a colleague in a neighbouring village, so that the young monk and the maiden had the veranda to themselves. When she had served him, and he had eaten his fill and chanted a blessing, the maiden prostrated herself three times before him and asked him to excuse her presumption. She had a confession to make, she said, and a proposal. His good looks and dignified bearing had impressed her deeply, so deeply that she had fallen in love with him. As her mother's only child, she would inherit the house where they lived, along with some land. If his reverence wished, he could give up the yellow robe and marry her. He would not have to work, and they could live happily together for the rest of their lives. She would be a good and faithful wife to him, and he would have no cause to regret his decision. The proposal took Visuddhisara completely by surprise. He had never contemplated marriage, nor had he ever felt any romantic interest in the maiden. Since he kept his eyes lowered in the presence of women, as a monk should, he had not even realized before how beautiful she was. Nonetheless, he promised to consider her proposal, whereupon she prostrated herself three times and left. During the next few days, Visuddhisara looked deep into his own heart. What he saw shining there, like a vein of gold in the depths of a mine, was a desire to be a monk for the rest of his life. And though tempted by the proposal he had received, and conscious that in Burma it was possible to leave the yellow robe without dishonour, he knew he had no alternative but to be true to that desire. When he and the maiden next had the veranda to themselves, he therefore told her that much as he appreciated her offer, he wanted to remain a monk and strive for nirvana. Deeply disappointed, she prostrated herself in silent acceptance of his decision. Nor was her proposal mentioned between them again. But she and her mother still came to the monastery every day, bringing food for him and his teacher, and continued to do so right up to the time of his departure for Bombay. Simply and unaffectedly as Visuddhisara told his story, I found it difficult to know which to admire more, the firmness with which the young monk had rejected the maiden's proposal, or the good grace with which she had accepted that refusal. A Western woman, I reflected, might not have given up so easily. The manner in which the two actors in the little drama had acquitted themselves, in fact, reflected credit on them both, as well as on the traditional culture of Buddhist Burma, within which they had grown up and whose values had no doubt influenced their behaviour. End of chapter 18.